This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So I want to welcome everybody here. My name is Alex Israel. I'd like to welcome Yossi Klein Halevi to Pardes today. He is a senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, where he co-directs the Institute's Muslim Leadership Initiative, which I hope Yossi will talk a little bit about tonight. The last time Yossi, we had the pleasure of, I had the pleasure of interviewing Yossi here. It was about his book Like Dreamers, which is quite an incredible work, talking about the lives of an entire unit of paratroopers who are the people who freed the cartel, liberated the cartel, and their different directions in which they went, and really describing a kaleidoscope of Israeli society. And once again, Yossi has written a landmark book here, which has become a New York Times nonfiction bestseller and tops the Amazon bestseller lists. And this time it is called Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor. And this is what we're here to speak about tonight and to listen to Yossi's understanding of this. So I know that some of you probably haven't read the book. So I wanted to begin by, for those of us who don't know the book inside, by asking you, Yossi, to explain a little bit why you are writing to your Palestinian neighbor. What is drawing you to be writing this book? Who are you really trying to reach out to, especially as, you know, I did see in the introduction of the book that it has been published online in Arabic, but you've written it in English. And maybe I'll throw in another question, which will give you a chance to expand. Has this been an extension of your work in your multi-faith programming at Hartman? Or what exactly is the story which brought you to engage in this project?
So, good evening, everyone. Really delighted to be back in Pardes, and thank you, Alex, for hosting and for inviting. It's hard to know really where to start in explaining the genesis of this very small book. It's a book that I think I've been writing for 35 years. And when I sat down to actually write it, it just poured out. And it was written in a matter of months, which for me is just an unthinkable rush job. Like Dreamers took me 11 years to write. And this took me seemingly 11 weeks. And the origins of the book really are in a journey that I took many years ago, in the late 1990s, into Palestinian society, and I wrote a book about that journey called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden. And that tells the story of an idiosyncratic journey into Christianity and Islam in this land, an attempt on the part of a religious Jew to experience something of the devotional lives, the inner heart of Christianity and Islam. I went into mosques and monasteries, and it was really about trying to overcome the historical legacy of our relationship with these two overbearing faiths, which are now minorities in a Jewish majority state. And so that was my initial attempt to try to make contact with the other side. And it was a very intimate contact. I went on this journey for the better part of a year. And then the Second Intifada happened. And meanwhile, my book came out after the beginning of the Second Intifada. In fact, it came out on September 11th, 2001. That was literally the publication date. I was in Manhattan that morning because we were going to have a book launch for the Garden of Eden book. And that convergence, that timing, for me, was really symbolic of my own relationship to that journey, which is that I felt that what I had tried to do was basically irrelevant. And I was vaguely embarrassed by the book because buses were blowing up here seemingly every other day. And the last thing that I wanted to do was really speak about the experiences that I had going into mosques in Gaza, for example. And I remember I would get emails from the rare reader, because the book completely died. When it came out on 9/11, it was clear that that was really the beginning and the end of that particular project. But every so often, I would get an email from someone saying, you know, I read your book, and it was so moving for me. And I would actually get a little bit angry and say, well, what moved you about this book? You know, do you think that just because I had these positive experiences and with a few Palestinians that really can change reality? You know, look at what's happening in the streets of Jerusalem. And so I was in this very uncomfortable position of repudiating a book that I had just published. You know, it's one thing to repudiate a book that you published 20 years ago. I think that's par for the course for writers. But here, a book had just come out, and I wanted nothing to do with this book. And then I got an email from someone I didn't know, named Abdullah Antepli. And he identified himself as a Turkish-born imam who had moved to the U.S., and was working at the time as the Muslim chaplain at Wesleyan. And he said he'd read the book and was very moved by my love for Islam. And I did actually feel love for Islam, and we can talk about that. And he said, I would like to reciprocate your journey by taking a journey into Judaism. And he said, my starting point is I'm bringing a group of students from Wesleyan, Muslims and Jews, to Jerusalem, and will you meet with them? Now, I understood that he thought he was writing to the author of that interfaith book. But who he met was a very angry post-Second Intifada Israeli. And what I basically told the group was, there's no chance for an agreement. There's nothing to talk about with this generation of Palestinian leaders. And Abdullah, who I since learned was a very patient man, nodded sagely and said, okay, that's how you feel now, but you and I will work together to help heal this wound. So fast forward to around 2012. At this point, I was already sitting at the Hartman Institute, and Abdullah showed up to the philosophy conference that the Hartman Institute organizes, and said, I want you to partner with me in a program that I'm initiating to teach about Judaism, Israel, Jewish peoplehood, Zionism to young emerging Muslim American leaders. Will you partner with me, and let's do it here at Hartman? And I said, sure, no problem, because I was convinced that nothing could possibly come of such a program. And a few weeks later, Abdullah sends me this who's who list of young, emerging Muslim American writers and journalists, and the Muslim chaplain at Yale, at Northwestern. And it was an extraordinary list. And so we put together this program. It's been going for the last 6 years. We've graduated over 100 Muslim American leaders. We teach them Israel and Zionism and Judaism. And I realized at a certain point that it's not enough for me to be having these deep interactions with Muslim Americans when every night I look out across the way. I live at the end of French Hill, literally the very edge, and the wall is on the next hill, and or in the valley, and then on the next hill are Palestinian villages. And every night I look across at these villages. And I had learned through the process of this program, I'd learned something about how to explain Israel and Zionism and Jewish peoplehood to a very skeptical audience of Muslim American leaders. And I tried to adapt what I learned in that conversation to an imagined conversation with my Palestinian neighbors in the hope of triggering a real conversation.
So I'd like to pick up on one, I think, very central aspect of your book, because you've spoken about explaining Israel and Israeli politics and Zionism to Muslims. But when I read your book, I noticed that it was a very, very religious book. It begins with you davening Shacharit in the morning, and it ends with Chag HaSukkot, and in between it visits many of the different Chagim. And you talk very, very deeply about religion, the Muslim religion and your Jewish faith. And I wanted to turn our attention when we talk about dialogue and resolving the conflict or making some bridges in any way. You know, many people will say that religion is the big problem here. I remember in the Oslo years hearing one of my teachers, Rav Yaakov Meidan, Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva Har Etzion, somewhat frustrated with the American brokered process of Oslo. And I remember him exclaiming very loudly, he says, "You don't make peace between a Muslim and a Jew the way of the Christian." Now, I know that you are a student of a very different rabbi, Rav Menachem Froman, Zichron Levracha, who actually believed that religion was the key, that actually it wasn't about politics, but it really was about religion. And in fact, he went on his own journey, even to meet radical clerics like Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. And he really felt that unless Judaism made peace with Islam, then we really wouldn't get anywhere in this conflict. It wasn't for the politicians, it was for the religionists. So I'm wondering what you think of this. Do you think there is a way to make this? Do you agree with this? Is religion the bridge? Can religion become a ground for dialogue, or will it just generate greater extremism? I think there's definitely a sense in much of the rational Western world that religion is the cause of a huge amount of conflict and turmoil in the world. So I want you to try and think a little bit with us about your reflections on this.
Well, I appreciate your mentioning Rav Menachem. He was my teacher, my friend, and also my chavruta, with whom I argued vehemently about many of the approaches that he took, including reaching out to Hamas and Arafat. I felt that he often went too far, but I said to him once, you know, it's a wonderful thing that there is one Menachem Froman, and it's a wonderful thing that there aren't two. And in some ways, I feel that, you know, what was so moving about him, I don't know if any of you knew him, any people here ever. Do you know who I'm talking about? Rabbi Menachem Froman, Zichrono Livracha, who was the rabbi of Tekoa, of the settlement of Tekoa, and was improbably the leading advocate and activist for Muslim-Jewish reconciliation in Israel. And he really was an example for me for violating borders. For Menachem Froman, there were no borders. And that was true for him as a settlement leader. And it was true for him as an interfaith activist. It was really the same principle. And what I learned from him, and this is really, I think, what you're getting at, is that religion is the problem, and religion can also be part of the solution. Rav Menachem would have said religion is the solution. I don't think that that's quite accurate. I think that religion needs to be part of a solution. And I wrote this book very intentionally as a conversation with a religious Muslim. Because in the Middle East, I don't believe that you can leave religion at the door when you try to make peace. The Oslo process failed for many reasons, and the main reason I believe that it failed is because the Palestinian leadership was not prepared to accept Israel's legitimacy, and at the moment of truth, that became clear. But one of the factors that undermined confidence in the Oslo process on both sides was that this was really an attempt to create a kind of an artificial peace between two secular elites on both sides, to circumvent the deep religious reservoir of emotions and commitments that you have on both sides, especially on the Palestinian side, but also on our side. And so the premise of this book is that religion needs to be at the table. If you exclude religion, it will sabotage whatever future negotiations may happen. And at the very least, you need to bring in a religious sensibility. You need to bring in a religious justification, an imprimatur for the concessions that both sides would have to make in order to reach an agreement. And those concessions need to be framed not only in Western terms, but in religious terms.
Okay. So I want to try and, you know, challenge you a little bit in what you've done in this book. And
join the club.
Yeah, maybe I'll quote some of those as well. Because you talk about a discourse of mutual dignity, and you talk about the fact that one of the problems is a cycle of denial, which both sides have. Many Israelis or Israel denying a sort of Palestinian sense of nationhood, but also Palestinians not really understanding Israel. And when I first saw the title and I sat down on a Shabbat afternoon to read this, I was really expecting it to be rather left-leaning. And surprisingly, as I got through the book, I was quite struck by the right-wing, very strident and unapologetic, in many cases, arguments that you were bringing, not at a policy level, but really in the faith claims and in the claims that you've raised. And on the one hand, you say you want to invite your neighbor into your spiritual home, and you hope that one day he will visit, or he or she will visit your physical home. But then you set debunking a whole bunch of Palestinian opinions, which you say, you know, you simply cannot hold. And you challenge them that when Palestinians say you're not really a nation, you're just a religion, you say, no, you can't say that. And you take them to task, and you talk about that when Palestinian leaders, and here I'm quoting, call the creation of Israel one of the great crimes of history and refer to a 70-year occupation, then you say the terms of the conflict aren't about politics, but about existence. You're trying to write us out of existence. You fight Palestinians who claim there never was a temple on the Temple Mount. I mean, I think that's correct, but, you know,
I think it's a correct, there was a temple.
Yes, I think it's correct, there was a temple. And you also challenge the line, which they will say that the only reason Israel exists is because of Western guilt about the Holocaust. And you're really trying to refute a lot of these assumptions, which are spread about in Palestinian society. But this is where I sort of am wondering, do you really think you're going to find a listening ear? You have, you know, that, so to speak, review in the New York Times by Raja Shahada, where he accused you of being condescending, if not insulting. And I think when I read the book, I was like thinking to myself, yeah, good luck with getting somebody to talk to you. Because you're not giving. I mean, we'll talk about a two-state solution a little bit later, but you're really trying to push. I mean, you acknowledge. You say the curse of our relationship is that my protection is your vulnerability, my celebration is your defeat. But when you're asking them to acknowledge so much of our narrative, what's the likelihood of getting a response from the other side?
So let me try to unpack what you've said and start with the strident right-wing voice. I'll quibble about the right-wing, and I will object to the strident. And the reason I quibble with the right-wing is I certainly come from there. I come from the right, and I write about my right-wing background. I don't write about the entirety of my right-wing background. That was another book. But I come out of the revisionist Jabotinsky school. I grew up in Beitar. I wore around my neck, talk about strident when I was a teenager, the map of not greater Israel, but greatest Israel, including Jordan. I mean, that was my formative upbringing. And where I'm at today and the sensibility with which I try to write this book is pretty normative mainstream Israel. I would say more centrist. And by centrist, I mean the willingness in principle to make far-reaching concessions, to say that any territorial concession, almost any territorial concession that will genuinely end the conflict is as far as I'm concerned, on the table. I think that's true.
I'm just going to interject that last time you were here, you described centrist as, you know, that each election you vote in order to repair the damage you did in the last one.
That's it. That's it. Well, fortunately now there's a bona fide centrist party. So, but that's a different question. So, for me, being a centrist means that in principle I'm ready to make far-reaching concessions. In practice, I'm very wary. I'm very aware of where I live and what the consequences will be. One way that I put it in the book is that I have two nightmares about a Palestinian state, and I think this really reflects a normative centrist Israeli perspective. One is that the first nightmare is that there won't be a Palestinian state. The status quo continues indefinitely. We find ourselves ruling over another people indefinitely with all of the consequences on our being. And the second nightmare is that there will be a Palestinian state. We go back to borders that are 9 miles wide. Hamas takes over a Palestinian state, and we have Gaza 5 minutes away from here. And I think that pretty much sums up how most Israelis today feel to one extent or another about the conflict. And really what defines whether you're right of center or left of center or center is which of these nightmares are more powerful. And for me, you know, there are mornings when I wake up and it's a right-wing morning. And I say to myself, are you out of your mind? How can we possibly withdraw? Look where you're living. And then there are other mornings when it's a left-wing morning. And I say, no matter what, just cut it, unilateral withdrawal. I saw there was a plan that just came out from one of the think tanks, the Israeli think tanks, showing how Israel can, with reasonable security, unilaterally withdraw from much of the West Bank. And I said, well, maybe. And so I think that many of us really are caught at that point. And so this book is really written from a very much not a left-wing sensibility. And I think that that's, for me, one of the innovations of the book, is that a conversation with Palestinians and a conversation of peace is not a left-wing interest. It's not a left-wing ideology. It is in my interest no less than in the interests of Shovrim Shtika, breaking the silence, to try to end the occupation of another people. And this is a national Israeli interest. And so I felt the need to try to make a contribution that would complicate the map a little bit. And this book has really confused a lot of people, and that's good. And it's also written from a perspective of frank confusion, because I think that is an accurate reflection of what our dilemmas really are. So in terms of what I expected from the other side, I didn't expect anything. That's first of all. And if you don't expect anything, you're not disappointed. I got lots of responses, not all of them negative. I got dozens of responses that were bordering on the genocidal, and that was par for the course. But I also got some very touching responses. A young woman in Gaza wrote me in Hebrew saying, I'm reading your book, and it's online in Arabic for free downloading. She said, I'm reading your book because I hope it will bring me hope. I've been invited for coffee all over the West Bank. I got a terrific long letter from a young man who grew up in the Dehesha refugee camp, writing, he called it Dear Future Neighbor. And he said, I call you future neighbor because as long as there's an occupation, we're not equal neighbors, but I hope one day to be your neighbor. And he writes about the key, the symbolic key that he received from his grandfather to the house in the north, in the Galil. And he says in his letter to me, I can't give up this key because that's my legacy, but I don't have to politically implement the key. and the Palestinians, and this I'm quoting him, are going to have to learn to separate the right from the return. And that's pretty much what I wrote in this book, is that there are two rights of return to the complete land of Israel and the complete land of Palestine. But in order for us to reach a reasonable agreement, each side is going to have to constrict its theoretical right of return to the whole of the land, to that part of the land where each people will exercise its national sovereignty. And he reflected that back to me in his letter. I got a long letter from a Jordanian who wouldn't tell me anything about himself except to say, I'm not Palestinian, but I'm also your neighbor. And he wrote, it was a 5-page letter, and he ends it by saying, this is a quote, "What the hell took you guys so long to explain yourselves to us?" And that, for me, I almost want to put that on the cover of the paperback edition. Because that, for me, that's what this book is about. We explain ourselves to Congress, to European public opinion. The Israel Project opens an office in China. Nobody has thought of explaining ourselves. And no Israeli writer has thought of writing a book to our neighbors. And so after all of these years, I thought it would be interesting to do that. And my wife calls it a paper airplane over the wall. And that's really what it was for me, just sending it out. Now, I have to tell you that in all honesty, I think this is pretty obvious, I had another readership in mind. And that was young American Jews, specifically, and anyone else who might be interested in reading how Israelis live this conflict, what this conflict looks like through fairly mainstream Israeli eyes. And so, in that sense, I felt that whatever happens, you know, somebody will read it somewhere. Now, the one problem that I had in thinking of these two audiences, and this goes back to your question about religion, is that in writing a frankly religious book to a Muslim Palestinian, and the only way that I personally could write this book to a Palestinian would be through a religious language, I'm making it much less accessible to most young American Jews, who would find a secular argument much more palatable. So there was a built-in contradiction, I'd say, between these two audiences. But if I had to choose between those two audiences, and I had to, then obviously the Palestinian audience came first. And beyond the Palestinian audience, I'm thinking of the region generally. This is a very particular moment in the history of the Middle East. The Saudis, the Gulf states, to some extent the Egyptians and the Jordanians are starting to take another look at Israel. And I thought this might be a good moment to have a book available in Arabic that would explain who we are and how we experience this conflict. And I have been getting responses from the wider region. I have a reader in Saudi Arabia who corrects the grammar in the Arabic translation. And I'm thrilled about it. My sense of my geographical presence has been expanded. My geography no longer ends at the borders of Israel. I now have some, however tenuous, relationships in the region. And I'm ready to take this book to Saudi Arabia if there's an invitation. I'm ready to go, not everywhere, but almost anywhere. And so this for me is really an experiment. That's how I relate to this. I just received a couple of grants to have serious social media outreach in Arabic. We're setting up an Arabic website. And so I hope within the next 6 months or so to be able to tell you more about the kind of responses. So far we've had about 1,000 downloads of the book in Arabic. And that's 1,000 more downloads than I expected.
Okay, so for those of us who are here who haven't actually had a chance to read the book yet, I know they're all going to go and purchase it at the end of the evening, but can you give maybe one example, maybe one of your favorite examples, of something that you really felt that a young Palestinian might not know about us, might not understand about our way of thinking? That you really wanted to bring out something that they might see a certain way, and you have been able to put it in a certain context, and tell us what you think. You know, how you think that new opening that door for that young person will help them to be able to maybe understand us better, and maybe open a bridge.
You know, when you speak to Palestinians, what you hear over and over again, and any level of Palestinian society, is that we have nothing against the Jews as a religion. The Quran says you're the people of the book. You can live happily under Islam, as you did for centuries. We don't accept you as a nation. We don't accept Zionism. And what I learned over the last years in teaching Muslim American leaders is that this perception or misperception of who the Jews are, that we are just a religion, is widespread throughout the Muslim world. We get graduates in our program of the best American universities, and they don't have a clue of how peoplehood plays in Jewish identity. And so I would say that in some ways the most important part of the message for me of this book to Palestinians is that you need to stop trying to tell us who we are, and you need to listen to who we are. In the same way that many Jews on the right will say there's no such thing as a Palestinian people because 100 years ago there was no self-conscious Palestinian national identity, that's trying to tell Palestinians that we know who you are better than you know who you are. And Muslims do the same thing to us. And so I spent a good deal of time here trying to explain how it's possible to be an atheist and still be a Jew in reasonably good standing. Because if you're a Christian or a Muslim and you're an atheist, you're out. There's no such thing as a good Muslim atheist. Try it. Try it. Ask Muslims. See what they think about Muslim atheists. And so the anomaly of the Jewish atheist really places the argument of peoplehood at the center of our identity. And it really is one of the distinguishing features that separates Judaism from Christianity and Islam. Christianity and Islam are universal faiths. Judaism is a faith that's meant for a particular people. And because it requires a people to carry it, peoplehood is a religious category for Judaism. Peoplehood is not just a national identity, it's actually a religious value. And so that's what I try to explain to my Palestinian neighbor. And the implications of that are immediate for our conflict. Because if we're just a religion, then this whole Zionist experiment is entirely misguided. But if we really are a people, then we are recreating our national identity. And when we explain that, when we go through when we teach our groups at Hartman what the sources, the traditional sources for peoplehood are, what it means that, for example, when Ruth converted to Judaism, she tells Naomi, your people will be my people, before she says your God will be my God, and how that really gives us some indication of how peoplehood is the ground, the common ground for our identity. This is really a revelation for the most educated American Muslim leaders. And so if we're ever going to have a real conversation with our neighbors, we need to start explaining who we are. And to say one last point about this, which is that the Jewish people today is pretty much divided between two commitments regarding Israel. There's one part of the community that's defending our narrative against the assault from without, and there's another part of the Jewish people that's trying to keep alive the hope of peace and of a two-state solution. And the implicit argument of the book is that the two are complementary. Because if we don't defend our narrative, then there is no real chance for reconciliation with the Middle East. The Middle East will never really accept us if it sees us as purely a religious group that has occupied territory, that has come to a land that we really have no national claim. And the fact that our legitimacy is being systematically denied in Palestinian society, in the media, in schools, throughout the Middle East, for me is a one of the great obstacles, maybe the great obstacle in the long term to reaching an agreement. And here I fault the Israeli left and the Jewish left generally for not more vigorously defending our narrative and not understanding how essential it is for peace, for reconciliation, to defend our story.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm going to ask a political question, then maybe we'll come back to religion.
This is all political.
Well, a real political question, which is the two-state question, the partition question. Strongly advocates, despite expressing your understanding of the Palestinian connection to the land and their desire to return to Haifa and to Yafo, that they have to give up on that aspiration and that dream. And likewise, you say in a similar way as, you know, in a widespread way, Israelis have limited their access to Har HaBayit. Likewise, in order to create some sort of political solution, Israelis are going to have to decide to relinquish their sovereignty or their ability to live in certain historic places, maybe Hebron or others. For many today, people talk about the two-state solution as being imperiled, that it is sort of in a state of, it seems to be slipping away. And you've written about it, so I wanted to ask you if you really do think this is workable, if this is a direction that we are going in, is it still going to be feasible? You know, we don't know what's going to happen in the elections, which is definitely going to be happening next year at some point. So where do you see this two-state solution? You know, it's the way you seem to have taken the direction of a workable peace for the two peoples. No. But is that disappearing?
For many years, as an op-ed commentator, I would be very skeptical publicly of the two-state solution and questioning the international community's naivete, questioning the naivete of many Jews to imagine that we could be on the verge of a two-state solution, and all it takes is Israeli will to sign an agreement and we'll live happily ever after. Now that the conventional wisdom is shifting in the opposite direction, and maybe it's because I'm a curmudgeon, but now I feel a very strong need to say not so fast. Don't give up on the two-state solution because the alternative is far worse. The alternative is Yugoslavia or Syria. That's the alternative to a two-state solution. And what I write in this book is that I detest the two-state solution. I loathe and fear a two-state solution. I fear the moment when we will have to pull our fellow citizens, drag them out of their homes, to which, from my point of view, they have as much right in principle, to live in as any of us anywhere in the sovereign state of Israel. But the alternative is worse. That's where I come out in the end. And so it is not a left-wing position. My starting point is right-wing. It's all mine. from the river to the sea. But my conclusion is there's another people that's there, and I don't want to be an occupier of another people. And I will have to give up part of what belongs to me in the same way that I'm expecting Palestinians to give up part of what belongs to them, which is Haifa and Jaffa and the Galilee. And so in that sense, I feel that we need to keep the possibility of a two-state solution open. Is it still a possibility? I think it is. I don't think we've reached the point of no return. You know, I remember writing in 1990 or 1991 when I was working for the Jerusalem Report. And I did a cover story called Have We Reached the Point of No Return? It was about the settlement movement. At that time, there were maybe 80,000 settlers in the territories. And my conclusion was, yes, we've reached the point of no return. Today, I will affirm there is no point of no return, at least not for the foreseeable future. There is still a workable basis for partition. If you ask me what gives me hope, it is certainly not the Palestinian leadership today, nor for that matter is it our leadership at the moment. But the region is undergoing such drastic transformations that we don't know what's going to happen literally from week to week here. And who could have imagined that the Saudis would be in a strategic relationship, a deep strategic relationship with Israel? That was inconceivable 5 years ago. And so there is a possibility of, at least one can imagine, bringing in parts of the region into negotiations, because the bilateral Palestinian-Israeli track is finished. Nothing will happen there. Nothing can happen there. The Palestinian leadership will not be able to make the minimal concessions that someone like me who wants a two-state solution needs in order to go forward. There is no Palestinian leader that I can think of who is willing to give up the demand for refugee return. And I don't call it a right of return. There is no right to destroy the state of Israel. It's the demand for refugee return. And it isn't refugees. It's descendants of refugees. So the whole terminology is wrong. And there is no Palestinian leader that I can think of in a position of power. I know several Palestinians who would make that concession, but they have no power. And so if it's up to the Palestinian-Israeli track, and if you factor in this government and you factor in Bennett and other forces, even and within the Likud as well, there's no chance for an agreement. But if you widen the lens to include the region, then, as we say in the Middle East, Elohim Gadol. And many of you here will remember, as I do, Anwar Sadat getting off the plane, being greeted by who? Menachem Begin. Who could have imagined that 2 weeks before, 2 days before it happened? And I was in the hospital then. My friend, as he picked me up from the hospital, and I was in a hospital in Washington, and I was half delirious. I had jaundice, and on the TV there's Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat, and I really didn't know if I was hallucinating. And now we just take that for granted. Yeah, sure, Begin, Sadat, they made peace. Who knows what's going to happen here? And if you factor in religion and faith, and you say, well, we're certainly not alone here, and this is part of some larger plan that's being worked out for humanity, which I believe, I hope is true, then really Elohim Gadol. And to say that there is no chance for peace is to limit God's greatness. It's to limit the possibility. It's to deny the possibility of miracle. And I think things are going to get much worse here. I sense that. I fear that we're heading, God forbid, toward a war with Iran and Hezbollah. I think we kind of sense that that's on some level almost inevitable. But that's not the only process that's happening here. There are other processes. And even if I've despaired of the Palestinian-Israeli track, the openings in the region are quite tantalizing.
Okay, wow, fascinating. I'm going to ask one final question, and then I'm going to turn it over to your questions. I will, by the way, request that people ask questions and not give speeches. But I'm going to ask one final question. Throughout the book, you keep on coming back to Hebron. And I found it fascinating. You come back to Hebron and visits when you go to pray to Davin in the Kever Machpelah, and you talk about it with a lot of love. You talk about Hebron as a place where you grew to really idealize the people who were the settlers there and following their ideology. And you describe it also as being the place that you grew to reject that movement because you saw the price it was exacting from the inhabitants of Hebron, the Arab inhabitants of Hebron. And I think you also relate to some of the extremism of the people who live there. And I have a very tortured relationship with Hebron. I never know what to think when I go there. And I just wanted to. I was very struck by your ability to have that really almost naive love for this place at the same time as acknowledging its really problematic nature. And I just wanted to hear you maybe reflect a little bit about that. You know, keeping that very interesting tension.
I'd say that Hebron is the place that I most love in this land, and that I feel most horrified by at the same time. And one doesn't contradict the other, or they do contradict, but they coexist. And Hebron is the place where the settlement movement basically began. I mean, Kfar Etzion was the first settlement, but that was really a reconstruction. Hebron is the place where the settlement movement was born. And Hebron is the place where the settlement movement, it seems to me, has the strongest argument. Because if we don't belong in Hebron, we don't belong anywhere on this planet. It's a city where Jews have lived on and off for 4,000 years. And Jewish life ended for only one reason, because there was a pogrom. And on the other hand, Hebron is the place where the settlement movement loses its moral legitimacy. And so you have these two realities coexisting, and I can't resolve that, and I won't resolve it. I have to live in that contradiction. When you said that that when there'll be an agreement and there'll be places where maybe Jews won't be able to live, I cringed when you said that. Because the thought of Jews not living in Hebron is unthinkable for me. On the other hand, this situation today is also unthinkable for the long term. So I don't know. Really, I have no idea when it comes to Hebron, what should happen, how it's going to happen. We will not simply walk away from Hebron. There will need to be, at the very least, a strong Israeli presence at the Machpelah. And whatever happens in the Jewish neighborhoods around there is an open question. But for me, Hebron really embodies the impossible dilemma that the settlement movement has placed us in, which is you can't walk away from Hebron and you can't stay in the Hebron of today. And be a country that respects itself with Jewish and democratic norms. That's on the other hand, and in Hebron, there's always another hand. On the other hand, the settlers are absolutely right. What sane people would walk away from the place of their foundation? We are, I don't know, is there another nation, I can't think of another nation, that knows the site of its ancient founders, its 4,000-year ancestors? I don't think that there's another people. Say it again? Somebody had the Japanese? Maybe. So would the Japanese walk away from Hebron? I don't think so. And so the settlement movement in Hebron is at its most justified and its least justified. That's where Hebron leaves me.
Okay. I don't know if there's anybody who would like to ask a question. Yes, Bob. Okay, who would be the most reliable negotiator for some negotiations? The PA, Hamas, who would represent the Palestinians?
It's really a great question. And I understand those in Likud in particular, and maybe Lieberman as well, who are so disgusted with Abu Mazen's duplicity that they prefer to just deal with the real deal and go right to Hamas. I don't see it. I take Hamas's rejectionism seriously. And I remember when Hamas came to power, there were these Western speculations that now that Hamas is in charge of taking out the garbage, they're going to have to be responsible. And that was such a Western misreading of what a movement like Hamas is. Hamas is not a political ideology. It's a theology. And the theology of Hamas is that we cannot exist here, and certainly not in a sovereign way. Thank you. And so I don't see how that's possible. Now, I recently spoke to Rabbi Melchior, who has continued Menachem Froman's outreach to Hamas, and he claims that he has heard from Hamas leaders that they're ready to accept Israel in one form or another. I find that very, very hard to believe. And so I don't know. But then again, if you would have asked me in October 1977, who could we make peace with in the Arab world, the last person I would have thought about was Anwar Sadat. So I don't know. And circumstances often create their own dynamic and produce the leader.
Okay. Yes. Okay, what was the question is, what was the Jewish right-wing response to Yossi reaching out to Palestinians, to Palestinian neighbors, etc.?
Well, you know, before I get to the critics, I'll say something very interesting that really surprised me about reactions to the book in the American Jewish community. The book was favorably reviewed by both the foreword and commentary. And I didn't think that it was possible in 2018 to have a book about Israel that these two publications could agree on. Now, what's interesting is they each reviewer liked the book for very different reasons. And when you read the reviews, they're really interesting. Each, you see that the reviewer doesn't want to like the book. That's true for both reviewers. And the commentary reviewer starts off by talking about by quoting a passage from the book where I'm sitting in the Machpelah, and there was a response from a Haredi young man that I really liked. He said something very positive about Islam, and I wanted to hug him. So the reviewer says, this is an occupational hazard of this author. He likes to hug people. And then he says, But if you will conclude from that this is a naive book, you've reached an unfair conclusion. When I read that line, I said, wow, I can't believe I've just passed the commentary threshold. And in the foreword, the review was also, it started out a little bit iffy, but then appreciated the fact that an Israeli is trying to reach out with respect to Palestinians. And I think that what each of them was responding to is that what I tried to do in this book, the sensibility that I really tried to hold here, is to expand my capacity for empathy with the Palestinians without forfeiting my narrative, holding those two in tension. And the way that discourse, as we know, usually happens on our side toward the Palestinians is we're either angry toward the Palestinians or we're apologetic. And I tried to avoid anger and apology and just write about my story and show empathy where I felt I could. And in terms of the negative responses from the right, there were those, you know, the harmless or let's say the more benign negative responses were, well, you're wasting your time. But that's okay. I can live. It's my time, and if I choose to waste my time, then there's no harm done. And I don't see the harm in trying to explain our narrative to anyone. Certainly not to our neighbors. The more nasty critique was that I'm trying to sell out to the left because you get better speaking gigs. Which is true, by the way. It is true. It is true. The Reform temple will pay a lot more than an Orthodox synagogue. And but you know, when somebody who actually knew, a former friend of mine from my Beitar days, wrote a letter to the Jerusalem Post, which inexplicably for me, the Jerusalem Post actually published, accusing me of writing this book to make money. Now, why would the Jerusalem Post publish such a letter? But we'll leave it at that. You know, when I read that, my immediate response was, halavai. You know? I mean, you know, finally, after, you know, 40 years of writing books, and, you know, it would be great. And so that was the kind of the direction, you know, of he sold out, but there were some reactions, you know, it's interesting, the far right and the far left both attacked the book. Mondo Weiss is this anti-Zionist Jewish website. Forget the name as soon as I mention it. It's one of the most obnoxious websites. And so there I was accused by someone of writing that if you're not a Zionist, you're not a Jew, which is completely ludicrous. I didn't write that, and I don't think that. Then on the other side, on the far right, there's a publication called Front Page Magazine, which is edited by the other David Horowitz, not our David Horowitz here. It's an anti-Muslim web, quite explicitly anti-Muslim, anti-Islamic website. And there I was accused of borderline anti-Zionism. And so I thought it was really interesting how the far right and the far left each perceived this book. And I was actually pleased to be attacked by both of these places.
Question is whether anybody from any official Palestinian organization, PLO, Hamas, whatever it might be, PA, gave any sort of response.
I became friendly with a young man, young Palestinian from Gaza, who now lives in the U.S., and we did a public event together in Washington. He's just written a book, a very powerful and disturbing book, but a book that I think we should read, about growing up in Gaza during the Second Intifada. And it's called The Words of My Father, and his name is Yusuf Bashir. And Yusuf was, until recently, the PLO's lobbyist to Congress. He's about 30 years old and a very impressive young man. And now that there's not a PLO delegation in Washington anymore, that's not his position. But he and I have developed a strong relationship. And so I wouldn't say that he certainly didn't reach out to me in his capacity as the PLO lobbyist in Washington. But that's as close as I've gotten to officialdom. And I'm also not really interested in the PA. I think the PA is so thoroughly corrupted. And those conversations just aren't interesting anymore. When you meet Palestinian officials, it's almost like hearing the same line by rote. It's very hard to have a real conversation.
Okay, there is a group, I don't think they've organized themselves fully politically, called Two States, One Homeland. So the question was, what does Yossi think about that?
Yeah, I like them a lot in principle. I don't really think it's workable. The idea of two states, one homeland, is that we are so entwined geographically that there's no way to remove the settlers, and you have to factor in 1.5 million Arab Israelis, Palestinian Israelis, who live on our side of the line, and that the only way in which this conflict can be reasonably resolved is if you recognize that all of the land, in effect, belongs to both peoples, and the idea would be that each people would have its own sovereign structure, but there wouldn't be a border between us. I can't imagine not having a border to the state of Israel in the Middle East, a clear, defendable border. And in principle, I like the idea very much. It would save us from having to uproot Israelis from their homes, from the unthinkable dilemma of being cut off in some way from Hebron. But I think it is a very clever theoretical approach that, in practice, I just don't see how we can maintain Israel's security under that kind of arrangement. I think our borders would be too porous. As soon as we're no longer explicitly a Jewish majority state with clear borders, we're opening ourselves up to a kind of diffusion and disintegration, and that's very frightening in the Middle East. And you look around the region and you see what that can look like. You want to follow up on that?
Okay, I'll just repeat the question. The question was, we've spoken about two audiences, right? The American, young American Jews and the Palestinian population, but what about Israelis?
Well, first of all, I disagree with the notion that Israelis aren't making peace because we live in a bubble and we're not impacted by the occupation. Or as John Kerry used to say, Israelis have it too good. Thank you very much, Mr. Kerry. And I think that Israelis aren't making peace because we know that there's no peace to be made at the moment. And I think that if there really was an opportunity, you would see a shift in the Israeli public. I think that Israelis live with such a high degree of insecurity and threat that this notion of a bubble is really artificial. I don't think we live in a bubble. We live from day to day in whatever reality throws at us. And we have a great capacity to inhabit the pretense of daily life, and we have an equally great capacity to instantly make the switch from daily life to emergency and then back again. I think that's one of the secret weapons of the Israeli psyche in coping with our situation. The book I hope will come out in Hebrew this year. I have a publisher. I'm looking for a translator. If anyone knows a good translator from English to Hebrew, see me after this. And I'm hoping that this book can trigger multiple conversations. There's the conversation that I hope to have between Israelis and Palestinians, or at least between this Israeli and whichever Palestinians will agree to a conversation. A conversation in the American Jewish community, which is, from what I sense, coming along nicely. And a conversation in Israel about can we really afford to pretend that we don't have Palestinian neighbors and to pretend that we're not occupying another people. Now, for many years after the Second Intifada, that was certainly my mindset. And I write in the book that I learned to not see across the hill. And it's a very beautiful view from my apartment if you look over the wall and you look past the Shuafat refugee camp. And then you have the expanse of the desert. You can, on a clear day, you can see the Dead Sea from my porch. It's very beautiful. But you have to learn how not to see what's before that expanse. And like most Israelis, for I think very understandable, legitimate reasons, we learned to stop seeing. And for me, for the reasons that I explained earlier in my own circumstances through being exposed to Muslim American leaders and the journey I had taken 20 years earlier, I no longer felt that I had the luxury of not seeing the next hill. And so I wrote this. And how this will be received here, you know, I'm ready really for any and every response. I think that Haaretz is going to hate this book because Haaretz owns peace, and a Jew with a kippah who doesn't vote Meretz cannot possibly be for peace. And you have no right to speak for peace. Peace belongs to my camp. And I think that parts of the Israeli right will hate the book for other reasons. And I think a lot of Israelis in the middle are going to be confused. What does this guy want? Does he want it? He wants a two-state solution. He knows a two-state solution is impossible. So why is he writing this book? It's not possible now. It's going to be possible maybe. So, you know, it's, I don't know. I really don't know. I can't say that I'm really looking forward to this coming out in Hebrew. You know, B'toch ani, ani yoshev, I know my people. And I'm thinking of my neighbors, you know, oh no, that's all I need, you know. This one's going to say, oh, he's a flaming leftist, and this one's going, you know, the whole thing. So, but yes, I wrote the book, I have to own it. And I have to own it in whatever language it will appear. It's coming out in Japanese, so it might as well come out in Hebrew.
Okay, I'd like to thank you all for coming, and I'd really like to thank Yossi Klein Halevi.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.